Welcome to the Business of Security podcast, brought to you by TrustMap for Security Performance Management. Your hosts are Chad Beckman and Malcolm Harkins. Today, their guest is Benny Lakunishuk, CEO at Zero Networks. Now let's get to it.
What does the industry need to start talking about that we're not doing today?
Information technology is built on a horrible foundation. If we could sort of redo and start from the beginning, we would be so much better off.
If you don't invest in it, keep it running, it will blow up.
We also have to be able to go in with solutions, not just problems. We have a long way to go if we're going to win this fight.
At the end of the day, educated people are really the best countermeasure against all the threats.
All right, welcome to the Business of Security podcast. This is Chad Beckman, and joining me, like always, is Malcolm Harkins. Welcome, Malcolm. How are you?
I'm doing great today, Chad. Thanks for having me.
And joining us today is Benny. Benny, welcome to the show, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Chad. Pleased to be here.
Yeah. Benny, you're from Tel Aviv, Israel. Is that right?
Yes, based in Tel Aviv, Israel, yes.
Have you lived there your whole life?
Yeah, I was actually supposed to move to New York recently as part of everything that we do in Zero Networks, and that's got basically postponed now till the Corona cloud will lift.
Got it. So tell us a little bit about your journey in cybersecurity and how you got started and what you're doing now.
Cool. So I started as a programmer back in my army days here in Israel. I then shifted to IT and security. And about after almost 6 years in the army, I went into Microsoft. Was lucky to be a part of a new services business in Microsoft that was just starting up, basically. And then after doing that for almost 6 years, I left and joined a very new and exciting startup back in the day called Awato here in Israel, which was then pretty quickly acquired by Microsoft and then became the lead product manager in our group in Microsoft. We were rebranded as Advanced Threat Analytics, basically the UEPA platform or the security analytics platforms, if you will, in Microsoft. I was the lead product manager. We grew very fast from like zero customers to a few thousands of customers in less than 3 years. Very, very fast. And then after doing that for a few years, I moved to Hexadite right as they were acquired by Microsoft and led the product team there as well. And basically the acquirer was the Microsoft EDR, Windows Defender ATP. A great group and a great product, and I was responsible for the R, so everything response, the automated and the manual stuff, and did that. And then a year and a half ago-ish, I left Microsoft again and opened Zero Networks. So that's real quick on myself.
Excellent. Wow, that's quite a journey. How many years does that approximately encompass?
About 20.
Yeah, all right. I think collectively on this call, we probably have 60 to 70 years of experience.
Wow. Yeah, making me feel old there, Chad.
Not intended, but hey, the listeners are getting a lot of value out of this podcast as a result. So Benny, you know, you've got some interesting perspective on the history of cybersecurity and, you know, based on your history of doing these various initiatives with different companies. And you kind of highlighted in a previous conversation we had about this progression from preventative to detective, and now the industry is leaning back into preventative again. Can you add a little bit of insight to that and kind of describe your observations of these trends?
Yeah, sure. And we'll actually be releasing a blog post in our site that will talk very deeply on all this, but we'll love to discuss. And basically, if you think about it, when networking and computers started for organizations mainly, you had pretty much like two simple tools, I would say. You had the antivirus, We started from a commercial side or consumer side before that, but it was quickly adopted into an enterprise-grade mode antivirus. This was more than 20 years ago, or let's say 20 years ago. And then alongside that, obviously, at the same time, end of the 90s, you had the perimeter-based firewall, right? So you had, okay, I'm building my network, and that's separated, you know, from the rest of the world because I want to be protected in my bubble. And that was the mindset, you know, I'm building my own castle and moat, my own bubble in which I'm protected. I'm augmenting that with antiviruses, which at the time, let's say 20 plus years ago, were okay, decent in stopping things. They were also very decent in breaking things, especially in the enterprise. I had a bunch of those experiences myself, and I'm assuming many had that. But those were like the tools, and those were the preventative measures. Everybody thought, okay, I'm going to put things which will prevent attacks, and that's it. We'll be fine. And then as time progressed, those, like, there were more and more markets, I guess, in cyber that were added with that assumption. How am I preventing, right? So you can think about IDS, IPS kind of things, and other things that were, how do I prevent? Then around 2010, let's say, when there was a lot of hype and more awareness around advanced attacks or APTs, everybody was talking about this. In conferences, I heard a lot of people speaking about it. You saw a lot of demos of, you know, great tools like Mimikatz and others that really showed that, you know, an attacker can really easily steal credentials, move in your network. There are many tactics for which an attacker can then do things in your network and he won't know about it. And the existing tools that we thought were, you know, protecting us are not adequate. And actually, maybe another note here on why they're not adequate is to talk about the antivirus for a second and why it has a very hard time in really stopping most things in a good way. Because, and that's also going to tie nicely to then the detection theme that started in those early 2010s. So the antivirus has two big constraints, which, by the way, the EDR today doesn't have. So the two constraints are, one, it has to be real time. So it needs to decide within, you know, a few milliseconds or similar to that, can that executable run or not? So it has to be very, very fast. It has to decide now. There is no postponing. Let's decide in a few minutes, which other detection solutions can do. When you're a prevention solution, you need to decide, and you need to decide now. So that's one constraint. And the second constraint is the false positive constraint. You cannot have even a 10% ratio of false positive. I would even say a few percentages of false positive would be bad for an antivirus solution or vendor, because that would mean, let's say 10%, that one out of 10 executables on average would get blocked, although it's, you know, just something simple that you need to run. And if that was the case, then you would not use that antivirus anymore because you need to work and you run like tens or hundreds of EXEs in the life of the computer or more, depending on, you know, the use case and who that is. So you have a very strong constraint of, you need like, I don't know, 0.1% of false positive. Let's say that's something, right? Less than 1%. You need a very, very small amount of false positive. And within the laws of physics in cyber, once you shrink down the false positive to that size, then on the other side, you have a lot of false negatives. That's just the physics of how these detections work. And because of that, you don't catch many things. Those are the two constraints that really cause the antivirus to really be, you know, it's okay to have it, but I mean, it's good to have it. I'm not saying that you shouldn't have it, but it's not going to stop your advanced attacks. It's not going to catch the new thing that's out there that's doing something. It won't, right? Another analogy that I always like to talk about is like it's having a door, even with a lock. Let's say you have a door. Everybody has a door with a lock on your in the front of your apartment or your home or house, and you lock it, and you understand that the advanced thief will open it. That doesn't mean you don't need the dough, because it, you know, keeps at bay the animals, or you know, the small thieves that don't know how to pick a lock or how to, you know, breach the dough itself. But you still need it. So it's the same with the antiviruses. So that's the constraint of that set of tools, antiviruses or endpoint prevention. And basically that was, I would say, the key thing that customers, when they understood in 2010, that those things will not stop the attacks. And they actually started seeing more and more of those. Okay, what do we do? And that unleashed a new set of detection thing that started to happen even a bit before 2010. So for example, the SIEM is a good example. It's like a repository that, you know, hosts a lot of things. We started to create some rules on top of that. And then, well, let's detect, let's see something. But then the SIEM, you know, it's not easy to see things there, as we all know. Also, not everything is in the events or in the things that the SIEM collects. So that's another thing. And then what started to happen is that the UEBA market, user and entity behavior analytics market, that Aurato, that startup that I was at, that was acquired by Microsoft, started to develop. Those were the first set of tools that were aimed actually at, you know, the security analytics tool to let's detect the advanced attacker. That's what we want to do. So you have, you know, the Hexabeam, the Securonix, Aurato, you have, you know, LightCyber, you have a bunch more mature, more, you know, it depends on the phase of the company and where it was that back then. But you have a bunch of companies that were trying to solve that. And I guess most of the markets were heavily relying on, you know, machine learning was all the rage back then. It still is to some degree. And everybody was relying on that. And even in Aurato, we were not a big fan of that. Like, we knew it poses, that, like, it has value, like, it can do things, but we knew that it cannot, we cannot just apply, let's take a lot of data, apply machine learning, and, you know, good will come out of that. It's not how it works.
Let's stop there for a second and kind of dissect what you said a little further. Why can't we take data and provide some analytics or behavioral patterns to it to expect to provide the protection that perhaps, you know, traditional malware or antivirus was performing? Why? What is sort of the weaknesses that you see or in general, some of the weaknesses machine learning has in preventing these types of threats?
So, like two answers to this. I'll start with one answer, which is like an example. And that's the example I always use with my Aurato pitches, or the ATA pitches after we were acquired. So let's say you perform pass the ticket. You take the Kerberos ticket or the identity, we steal the identity of someone in an organization, and we pass that into another machine, the attacker's machine. And now we basically use the credentials of that user from that machine. And that's a very small deviation. Let's say that user normally logs on to two machines, and from there accessing a few, you know, 10, 20 servers or 10, 20 other machines in the network. And then all of a sudden there is another deviation of those credentials of that user is being used from another machine. That's a very small deviation. So if you set the threshold to alert on that, you would alert on many things that are happening in the network. And that is the root cause, I guess, for so many false positives. Because once you apply that, if you don't really think on the threshold, you would just have so many false positives and so many regular anomalies or these benign things that just happen all the time in the network. Other applications that are just accessing, it's normal for them to do it, but it's abnormal from the data perspective.
Can you define that and what is meant by that in defining that threshold?
Yeah, so for example, what's the threshold from which you think it's good to alert, you know, let's say it's my credentials that were stolen, Benny's credentials were stolen from Benny's laptop to, you know, this and this machine, PC, or you know, in the network. If it's a threshold of when we have one deviation, right, then let's alert. And that just doesn't fan out because users, you know, they have new machines. Now they log on from Dell. So do you alert on that? Because if you set the threshold too low, you would just alert on normal things, changes that are naturally happening, which are not malicious by nature. They're just benign. Maybe it's, you know, it's a new thing that's happening, but it's not something you should alert on.
It reminds me of the integrity checking solutions. Whenever a file is saved or changed, you can be alerted on those changes. And so thinking back in the early days, there's a product I won't name, but that was popular for integrity checking. And that's essentially what you're describing, I believe, is configuring those rules and those thresholds to determine what should be alerted or stopped and what should allow to pass. And so that seems like it, what you're describing is too broad, where you could unintentionally allow malicious actors through, even though you're trying to tune your threshold appropriately for your user base.
Yes, exactly. And just to make sure that everybody's on the same page, the machine learning algorithm should tweak that threshold by itself. Like, this shouldn't be, ideally, if you want to really call it machine learning, although, again, that term, by the way, is really also misused and abused, and there are people doing it. They're not doing machine learning. They're doing some statistical algorithms. But in any case, if you're truly a machine learning or learning algorithm, then you that algorithm needs to decide by itself the thresholds and the features and how can I separate, you know, what's normal and what's not normal in the network. And I guess that's the second set of the answer. That's a more philosophical. We're not as advanced as we think. Like, we think we've invented AI, you know, and we have all that. We're not there yet, right? Well, and this is just my opinion here, but I think we are at the beginning of that journey, so that all these buzzwords that sounds really cool will actually be as good as they sound. We're not there yet.
Where are we in that journey? You know, on a scale of 1 to 10, so, you know, simply 1 being sort of the infancy and 10 being an extremely mature capability. Where would you place AI as an example on that scale?
Wow, that's a hard question. I guess if I have to pick a number now, I would say 2 or 3. That's what I would say.
Mel? Chad, to add on to that, you know, having spent time at Cylance, right, in the early days of machine learning for endpoint protection, I completely agree with Benny. You know, traditional antivirus, by and large, I mean, I started seeing deterioration on that capability when I was back at Intel 2006, 2007, right? I do think you have to look at it. And again, I'll give you an Intel analogy. You know, when you're building a silicon factory and you're shrinking the nanometers and you're increasing the wafer size for the die, it's called process technology, right? It's a manufacturing process technology leadership as you're bending the laws of physics and creating new chemicals and all that type of stuff. I think the same kind of concept of process technology leadership lends itself to machine learning. And there are some applications of machine learning that are in its infancies, and then there are some that are much more advanced. And, you know, when I was back at Cylance, we had published a paper around the process generations of machine learning. And we had forecasted a few years ago that Cylance was at about a 3, 3.5. But, you know, you could see yourself into, you know, 5 might be that fully autonomous type thing, right? Where, you know, humans are still curating some things, but their care and feeding of the machine is dramatically less. And in what Cylance was doing, the features that you're extracting are happening and growing, right? So that your efficacy stays high. And so I think depending upon how you look at that, you know, segment by segment, you might have different maturations. But I think the other thing that's important to note when you know, and Benny, I think, was spot on with, there's a bunch of people, and they started doing this a few years ago, just slapping machine learning and AI on everything as a, you know, architecture thing when they weren't really doing it. And I think one of the things that I learned, again, back at my Silence time is when Silence would convict on something, unless you opened up and looked at the feature sets, we didn't know why it convicted. It was the math that convicted it. And until you tease that out, and when people know automatically why they convict something, there's a rule or a signature. If they don't know until they dig into the machine, it means the machine did it. And so that's one easy way to see who's really doing machine learning versus who's just got, you know, updated signatures or rules or some behavioral heuristic, which is in essence a rule or a signature. So I think there's ways to really tease out who's doing what and who's not.
That's a nice way to describe sort of determining the BS meter of what's real machine learning and what isn't.
I very much agree on that. And I was about to say, in continuing to what Malcolm said, that in specific settings or specific scenarios, machine learning may be more advanced than that general meter that I just gave on 0 to 10. Like, you have scenarios where it's actually a very good tool and it's doing a very good thing, but just broadly, generally speaking, we're not there yet. That's what I was about to say. Yeah.
Take us down that path you were going as well, Benny, on AI. How does that differ from the machine learning, or is that an evolution of machine learning?
It's really more like, I guess, a marketing thing, and like an AI behind the scene needs to have machine learning, and it's more like you use the term machine learning to describe, okay, I have for that task, you know, I have machine learning. Then that term just evolved.
Yeah, it's funny because I hear other vendors talk about AI and machine learning. That's literally the phrase they use. Yeah, our product delivers AI and machine learning, and that causes so much confusion. To Malcolm's point, the architecture of the industry. So it's nice to get some clarity on this.
Well, I think machine learning is a branch of artificial intelligence, right? It's probably the one that most people have been using for a while, and it started years ago with big data and analytics, and evolved into it, right? And so, when you break that down, artificial intelligence today is kind of known as narrow AI or weak AI. It's designed to perform narrow tasks, right? And then you think of strong AI, and that's really, where you might outperform some cognitive things in human behaviors. And I think those things are at the earliest stage. Other things in the machine learning spaces are more mature. That's why I think, again, you have to break it down and talk about which type of AI you're thinking about, and then think of machine learning, like I said, as a branch or a subset of a broader concept of artificial intelligence.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah.
So going back to that, like the discussion of like prevention to detection and back to prevention, unless we want to dive deeper into another subject.
No, it's great discussion, because as you can tell, I myself was a little muddled on these terms and the differentiation. So that's very good for describing. Thank you. So yeah, let's go back to the prevention, detection, and prevention lifecycle.
Yeah, so I mean, the UEBA, again, was at its peak, I guess. And then it's because most of them were purely based on SIM data, events, and other things, I guess it was very hard, plus, doing machine learning on that set of huge amount of data, they were, I won't say causing more harm than good, because that's a big, saying, but they did cause a lot of false positive. That's when the false positive fatigue, I guess, really lifted off as well. Maybe a bit sooner than that, maybe a bit later, but that's where I, as a product guy within that market, really saw that from customers and when we talked. And we really, we wanted to set us apart, really have a very low amount of false positives, use machine learning only when needed, only for things that we know that will have very predictable outcomes, and for the rest, just have deterministic detections. So we had a very unique approach of that combination. And then at that time, let's say 2014, maybe a bit later, a bit before, depending on the company, the EDR market started. So the endpoint detection and response. And EDR is king. Like EDR won the game, the detection game for sure, because it had optics into what's happening in every machine in the network, right? It had an agent or sensor, or whatever you want to call it, and it can see everything, like the memory, the processes, the files, everything that's changing on the machine, everything that's happening. So it's not just like in the UEBA or the networking side, applying, you know, detections or machine learning on data or on events. Like you're applying that on actual things that are happening in the machine, and then that's why basically you have better detections from the endpoint. And I think in the detection space, customers understood that that is king. That is the best tool to give me the visibility into attacks and also to be helpful with the response, so that the SOC can also have a tool on how can I respond and what can I do once something happens. So that naturally happened. And then there were side branches of that, like other maybe themes or big features like deception and like other things that happened, like the SOAR market that potentially can also tie up into the SIEM, but basically most of them really tied up nicely, as you can see with some of the acquisitions, with the current detection platforms, mainly the EDR. So you can see Exadata being acquired by Windows Defender ATP, the Microsoft EDR, and you have a bunch of other examples that are like aligned nicely into the endpoint suite and with other vendors as well. And then as that happened, let's say again, about 5 years ago, around that time, maybe started to take more acceleration a couple of years ago, you started seeing a shift towards prevention again. Oh, okay. So we started with prevention. We understood it's not enough. The advanced attackers are here. Now we have all of these detection capabilities, potentially response. Some are manual, some are more automated. But you know, those are usually sometimes, I would say, too late. You know, you consider a loud SOC in most customers. They are swamped with alerts. And it takes like at least a few hours or days even to respond and to do something. So at that time, it's already too late. Even if potentially some of them you could somehow automate, but not all alerts, not all incidents you could automate. And then we started seeing, well, how can I have better controls to help me prevent things? And then you started seeing things, controls in the cloud, controls, you know, in your on-prem network. Controls that are hybrid, right? These are mainly networking controls. Like you see a host of things around like zero trust, although that's a term I don't like. Another term that's really misused and overloaded, but things like the micro-segmentations market or the software-defined perimeter, which evolved into the zero trust network access market and other like markets that are now trying to have much more granular and network controls on who can do what. Because if you can control that in a good way, then you know it's a different ball game for attackers now because they cannot have that network as they need. So that's like a shift that we are seeing. And that's also in the mindset of customers. Regardless of the solution, like customers want to take more preventative measures. That's also something that I think is more predominant today.
Yeah, listening to you describe that journey that the industry has gone through, you know, I can think back like 15, 20 years ago where just capturing logs and reviewing the logs for incidents, right? It sort of began even back, you know, I would say the early 2000s with detection. Then we went to prevention, now detection, now prevention again. It seems like it's an interesting cycle And I think a lot of that is based on, and correct me if I'm wrong or if you have a different perspective here, I think a lot of it is due to the progression and adoption of different technologies and different demands of how a business might be operating or delivering their own products. I don't know, what do you think of that? Does that sort of match this life cycle pattern that we just described?
So yeah, I think there is something there, because like as a company starts to develop a set of solutions, then that evolves, and then there's another company that tries to do something a bit different, and then there is another wave of things that evolve. And so that wave between evolution of products and evolution of capabilities, and also the, I don't know if that's the psychology behind cyber or the preparedness of organizations and like the steps that we are always taking to be better and having more controls. I think that also plays a part into that. Like what we are willing to do today, we're not willing to do a few years ago.
Hey, Chad, as a complimentary thought, we've talked about the, and I've seen this right in my time running security and multiple organizations, you know, this almost kind of sine wave of, let's go from prevention to detection response, much like I see a sine wave of let's focus on endpoint to let's focus on network. Both things are occurring, right? And in both areas. And I have a view of it from my time running security. And I have this a published set of irrefutable laws of information security that I've published in my books and I talk about. One of them is the efficacy of control deteriorates with time. And so when you think about it from that perspective and you think about investment cycles, if my prevention is starting to deteriorate and there's nothing good to up my prevention, then I shift my investments to detection and response. If my endpoint controls are deteriorating and there's nothing dramatically good, I shift my control to the network. And then once the network's hardened up, when I see something better on the endpoint, I go back to the endpoint. And so you have these constant waves of endpoint to network, prevention to detection and response. And I think by and large, it's based upon the efficacy of control and its deterioration and whether or not there's a good enough substitute. And so you're making investment decisions that are creating those, in essence, waves between the different control points and the different type of control.
It's a very good point. It's about continually monitoring and reinvesting when a control is like a gear where it's starting to wear out or not be as effective as it used to be. And so that's what you describe as a natural reaction.
Exactly. Now, the problem that I see with many organizations is we hold on too long to the shitty gear that we've had for a while instead of being transformational in nature. And again, if you think about it from a market perspective, whoever is the first mover who executes that first move correctly has the market position, right? And I think the same thing comes when I look at it from a control perspective. If I'm more aggressive and assertive on transformational controls that'll allow me to leap ahead, I will end up with a stronger risk management program. I'll end up with a higher level of security, a higher level of privacy. Now, along with that comes with perhaps some risk, because you're on the bleeding edge sometimes in doing that. But if you know how to manage that bleeding edge risk of being transformational and you're setting the pace and you're the one out in front, you're going to be better protected from the risks that are affecting everybody else.
Mm-hmm. It's almost goes back to the old analogy of running faster than the other person, right? If there's a bear attacking in some regards, in terms of adopting new technology, because you're not the soft target, even though that does come with its own independent risk of using technology that might not be widespread and totally proven yet in the marketplace. Very, very
exactly.
Right. Very good point.
I always like hearing Malcolm speak. Like, you can hear the years of experience that's just, you know, oozing from him. I like it. And you speak.
Yeah, we're very fortunate to have him on the show. So Benny, take us through a little bit about what you're doing at Zero Networks, and educate the listeners on how you're addressing, you know, the current threat landscape with your approach.
Sure. So, you know, continuing that prevention phase that we're at, and maybe actually also complementing something that Malcolm said, like, we want to, I guess, merge the network and the endpoint together, like, do it at the same time. And basically what we do is we say that every machine is the new, every machine and every entity is the new perimeter. And every machine should protect itself. And even if it's inside the network, it's potentially, you know, surrounded by hostiles. Like, there is no more inside of the network. And in an automated way, agentless way, I know that sounds like architecture, but it's for real. And basically make sure that every entity, every asset in the organization protects itself. And it's basically using the built-in controls that you have or own as an organization without adding that agent, in a way that's also self-sufficient. That's another big problem with, you know, putting all of these network controls, or controls to begin with, is that you need to manually configure them, create all of the rules, who can do what. And if you really want to make sure that the exposure or the risk is down to almost zero, you need to do that one by one. Like, what can Benny do in the network? What can Malcolm do? You know, what can Chad do? And you cannot do that times thousands or tens of thousands of employees that you have. That won't fly, because you will need to update that all the time, and you will need, you know, hundreds of people. And so the more airtight it is, the harder it is to maintain those controls. And we basically have a patent pending on a key thing on how can we make that in a self-sustained way by using the users, democratizing, if you will.
Democratizing,
security, if you will, by giving the users the ability to say, hey, it's really me. I can pull this me with the phone. So give me that access. And they don't need to request from their security team or the IT team to do that for them. And that's how you can really scale this and have that airtight.
So is it sort of like automatic provisioning of resources?
So it's not resources, but it's automatic
creating
and enforcing of network policies or network rules, if you will, and constantly maintaining that for you. So your the IT, the network security, they don't need to worry about that. If they want, they can customize something there, but it's self-running, and it can create, you know, millions of rules and maintain them automatically for you. So that's basically what we do.
Interesting. It's when you showed me a picture, it stuck in my head. It was a very good diagram of what you do, and that's what I think of is almost a user by user virtual network segmentation is probably the layman's terms of describing it. But it's fantastic, fantastic idea. And you guys just had some recent success. Do you mind sharing that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. So we were just announced by Forbes as top 20 cyber companies to look at the 2020, which was amazing. And just yesterday also, I think, or today, Gartner released an updated guide for the Zero Trust Network Access market. And, you know, we're there as well, which is great. As a very, you know, it's a big list, mostly with, like, big companies. And we're, you know, this year plus old company, which is there. So that's an amazing accomplishment. And we're very thrilled and happy about that.
Yeah, as you should be. A lot of hard work, I know, goes into creating the position you have right now within just over a year's worth of time. So that's quite impressive. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
You know, Benny, is there anything you'd like to leave our listeners with in terms of lessons learned or wisdom based on really what we spoke about today?
Yeah, so I think there is no silver bullet. I'm not going to pretend, you know, install Zero Network, that will solve it. It's not like that. You need, you know, multiple things. You still need detection. I'm not saying you don't need, like, obviously you need multiple things. I think definitely you need better network controls and other sets of controls. Obviously, I'm biased, but I do think that Zero Networks is a very good network control piece that you can test out. But just having that mindset that, you know, we need to adapt to this new world, even pre-corona, of, you know, making sure how can we be in that preventative state, especially in corona, where there are potentially more risk coming from all of these machines connecting from the outside inside to my network. Having that mindset and looking out for those new controls that can really help you safeguard before something happens, I think that's what I would invest in.
Excellent recap. Well, thank you again for joining us and sharing your knowledge, as well as the observation of security. We covered a lot of interesting topics today and appreciate the time you spent, Ben.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Business of Security podcast brought to you by TrustMap. We want to hear from our listeners. If you have a topic you'd like to discuss on the podcast or would like to continue the conversation, please connect with us on Twitter at CyberSecPodcast or email us at businessofsecurity@trustsds.com. A special thanks to today's guest, Benny Lakunashuk, CEO at Zero Networks. Our hosts today were Chad Beckman, founder of TrustMap, and Malcolm Harkins, Chief Security and Trust Officer at Cymatic. You can connect with both Chad and Malcolm on LinkedIn and learn more about TrustMap at trustmap.com. You can find out more about Malcolm and Cymatic at cymatic.io. Our show was produced by Dan Rollins with LiveWire Films. You can connect with Dan on LinkedIn and learn more about LiveWire Films at livewirefilms.com. Now stay tuned for our next episode of the Business of Security podcast. And that's a wrap.